Views, important subject for practitioners of mindfulness, I feel. And one of the points I think I was trying to make is that when we engage ourselves in Buddhist practice, it isn't so much that we're engaging ourselves with Buddhism and trying to learn about Buddhism the most we can, but rather what we're trying to do is study ourselves. We're trying to look within ourselves for what is truest for each of us. So it isn't that we use Buddhism as a standard for our life, but rather we look within us to really be able to see what is truest. And mindfulness practice, one of the ways of talking about it is in mindfulness practice, we're cultivating the freedom to be able to look at whatever needs to be looked at. So rather than coming to some kind of necessary adopting some view or some system or some larger picture of reality or of our life. Mindfulness practice is the process which frees our sight, frees our awareness, so we can very carefully be attentive to what needs our attention. And that's not so easy because of the amount of bias and prejudice and fear and aversion we have to many things that occur in our life. So what I'm going to talk about, what I want to talk about tonight, maybe not so, I don't know if this follows from what I said so already, but is the issue of resolve. And it's kind of a way of introduction to this. So I want to say that another way, or one way of talking about mindfulness, it is the practice of including in awareness whatever it is that's excluded. That mindfulness practice is including what is excluded. And it's the inclusion of all of our life and all of our humanity into the field of, maybe on one hand, the field of our appreciation, or on the other hand, the field of our compassion. Those two. And I think it's so easy to exclude. We exclude so much from our life, mostly because it's painful. And as maybe humans in general, but certainly our culture, we're experts at avoiding, at excluding things which are difficult and painful. Or we're simply too busy. I think a lot of us in our modern world live such a busy and speedy life that the speediness of our life doesn't give us a chance to pay attention, to include in our awareness many aspects of who we are. Sometimes I've heard people complain or express the fear or worry that if they devote themselves to spiritual life, to spiritual meditation, that they'll no longer be able to live a real life, or their life won't be real anymore. And I think if that's the sense you have of your spiritual life, of your meditation life, then your devotion to that spiritual life is a devotion which is excluding things from your practice. That if you feel like your practice has nothing to do with your life, your personal life, the way it manifests itself and unfolds, then either you should drop it, walk away from your spiritual life, or pay attention and see what is it you're excluding. So spiritual life is about including your life rather than excluding anything. Your life should become, in a sense, richer rather than poorer. In some areas of modern psychology, this expression, many of us know now, the shadow. And the shadow, I don't know if the technical definition of it, but the way I understand it is that area of our life which we tend not to be aware of, often because it's eclipsed by some stronger emphasis that we give to some other idea, some other value, or some other image we have of ourselves. So it's that which is kind of buried in the conscious or hidden in the shadows of brighter lights. And that mindfulness practice is very much about bringing the shadows alive, bringing the shadows into the light. So in thinking about this, about inclusion and shadows, I want to talk about resolve. And the connection is that in the way I teach, the kind of things I talk about when I teach, My teaching has shadows, or things which are excluded. And one of the things that, and there's many things which I don't include for many reasons, maybe. And some of you see them much better than I do, maybe. Some of them there's things I leave out. So I was thinking about this weekend about that. And one of the things I haven't never talked about is resolve. And I think resolve is a very important issue for people doing spiritual practice. And I'd like to talk about it a little bit. I think one of the reasons why I've shied away from talking about resolve is that it's very easy for resolve to shade into striving or struggling, or to be goal-oriented in some kind of unhealthy way. And as many of you probably know, I don't particularly care for a spiritual practice which involves struggling or striving or goals. So I guess resolve tends towards that direction too easily. Before I actually start talking about resolve, bringing it up at least, I want to say that we often exclude ourselves in some very basic way from our practice. And that we tend to overlook so easily the preciousness and the sacredness of ourselves and our own life, of life itself. So many people, maybe because of their childhood and they weren't recognized, they weren't seen, no one knew them, don't even know how to see themselves, don't even know how to recognize themselves in some very fundamental way, let alone the preciousness of being alive. And I think that the Buddhist teachings of no self certainly doesn't help us to recognize the sacredness or the preciousness of our own existence. The Buddha, said that like in human birth or human form, the chances of being born as a human being are the same as the chances of a blind turtle swimming in the ocean, popping its head up through a log that had a hole in the middle of it. So you can imagine this log floating in the middle of the ocean, and that this blind turtle somehow should find that hole. And when it surfaces, it goes through that hole. That's the same chance that turtle has, that's a chance we have of becoming human beings. It's very precious and very rare to be born as a human. So the Buddha said, the whole world we travel with our thoughts. If you kind of imagine or do a kind of a thought exercise, kind of thinking of everybody in the world, you will find no one. You'll find no one who is as precious as one's own self. Since each person, every person, is so precious to themselves, let the self-respecting harm no other being. So I don't know if you necessarily agree with that, but the idea being that part of the implication, I think, of the Buddha's teaching is that it's okay to and appropriate to feel that you are very precious. Not only are you precious, but for yourself, you are the most precious person in the world. And in our culture, that's kind of a no-no. It's kind of conceit or arrogance or excessive focusing on yourself. And at least in the Buddhist tradition, it emphasized that even though there's no self, we have to honor and respect ourselves as being very dear and precious. I was neurotic for years. I was anxious and depressed and selfish. Everyone kept telling me to change. I resented them, and I agreed with them, and I wanted to change, but simply couldn't, no matter how hard I tried. What hurt the most was that, like the others, my best friend kept insisting that I change, so I felt powerless and trapped. Then one day, another friend said to me, "Don't change. I love you just as you are." Those words were music to my ears. Don't change, don't change, don't change. I love you as you are. I relaxed, I came alive, and I suddenly changed. Now I know that I couldn't really change until I found someone who would love me whether I changed or not. And in this story, it's someone else. But for some of us, it's very important to have other people love you, but also we can do it for ourselves. And for a lot of people in our culture who have been neglected or not loved as children, maybe that's the only way you can finally heal that kind of wound, is to find some way to love yourself in the end. And to keep looking for it outside might be possible. Often it's not healthy, and sometimes it doesn't work. At least sometimes. But definitely you can do it for yourself. You can do it for yourself. And that's part of what meditation practice is about. There's a story about Aldous Huxley. Aldous Huxley spent his life kind of exploring what he called a perennial philosophy, spiritual traditions all over the world. And then a story is that as he was dying, right near the end of his life, he said something like that it was rather embarrassing for him to come to this conclusion after all his years of study. But after studying all these religions, the main conclusion he could come to is that spiritual practice is mainly about being kinder to oneself and to others. But being kind to oneself doesn't mean we pamper ourselves. And this is something which is often confused, the difference between being kind and loving ourselves and pampering ourselves. There has to be a resolve and a following through with that resolve for a spiritual practice. And resolve is important because a spiritual transformation does not happen by accident. We need to repeatedly place ourselves in the cauldron of our life in order to let go of old habits of mind, of the partiality of the mind that keeps many areas of our life excluded. And I like this image of a cauldron. Sometimes our life feels like a cauldron. We put ourselves in this hot boiling. You know, it's not comfortable in a cauldron. Often that's what, you know, our mindfulness is this wonderful container, this pot that's cooking. And our task is to open our heart, open our awareness, our mind, to feel the full range and aspects of what it is to be a human being. And find some way to hold that in the cauldron, totally, without kind of trying to push some of it out of the cauldron or away from the cauldron or not to feel it. And by feeling it, letting it, now who knows what's going to happen? Who knows how the healing happens? Who knows how the broth is made in the cauldron? But mindfulness is to put our life in the cauldron. And in the practice of inclusion, to include, we can't hold on to anything. To hold on is to be partial. And when you're partial, you're not able, your awareness is not free to see what has to be taken care of, see what has to be attended to. And so much we're afraid to look at ourselves, afraid of seeing something unpleasant, afraid of pain. So often people come to me on retreats and talk about how they feel their emotions are going to overwhelm them. They feel they're going to be overwhelmed. And I've never known anybody to be overwhelmed by their emotions. I mean, it can be very, very difficult and very painful. But what we learn in the practice is we learn eventually that it's trustable to experience even the deepest forms of pain. And that kind of trust to experience our pain, heartbreaking pain, hopefully is what this practice will enable us to do, to have. It occurs to me, as I've heard Jack Kornfield say, that hearts were made to be broken. So what does that mean? Hearts are made to be broken. Can there be a wide enough trust that we can allow our heart to break? To fixate on a goal, I believe, is to be partial, is to have partial attitude about what we're paying attention to. It's to focus on a part rather than being available for the whole. And that's one of the reasons why I'm not so keen on goals in spiritual practice. And I found it interesting. I read recently an account of a researcher, a scholar, who went to Amaravati, the English monastery where Ajahn Sumedho is, in the early days when they were there. And he wanted to kind of interview and study these monks and people who are practicing there. And he had kind of interviewed many of them and asked them why they came there, why they became monks, why they were practicing, what benefit they had gotten from the practice and how they'd changed. He got, you know, the whole rundown. And in the end, in the conclusion of his study, he said, for a lot of the more senior monks and nuns at this place, they didn't talk about mindfulness or calm or equanimity as being the goal or the result of the transformation of their practice. He said the older students tend to think those things were kind of like, they took us for granted. They were kind of like, almost like byproducts. And for the senior students, what was important was an opening of the heart. And that was what had the most value for them. What they felt was the most transforming was an opening of the heart. And I don't know if opening of a heart, maybe it can be a goal, but it belongs to one of those kinds of goals which doesn't focus, doesn't have some fixed thing you're trying to reach that's separate from where you are right now. It's one of these kind of goalless goals, the kind of these goals that actually bring you more fully into the present, brings you home to who you are. I think it's significant that, at least in Western languages, that we talk about the heart as being both the seat for love and also the seat for courage. And I think that it takes a tremendous courage at times to do this mindfulness practice. And sometimes teachers talk about having a warrior's attitude, approaching this practice like a warrior. And my teacher, Pandita, he was really into the warrior approach to spiritual life. As most of you know, I think I shy very much away from that kind of warrior attitude because it seems at times kind of violent. And it's often an attitude which ends up excluding things rather than including things. But whether you like the warrior attitude or not, I think it requires at times a tremendous amount of courage to do this practice, a courage to stay in the cauldron, a courage to stay in the practice, stay present for the kind of difficulties and pains that we have, not to turn away from it. So I looked up the word resolve in the dictionary, not to find a definition, but to see what the roots of it were. And I was delighted to see that the word resolve comes from the words, the root comes from solve, and solve comes from the Latin word meaning to set free, or to loosen, or to untie. Now that fits really perfect, I thought, that the resolve we have to sit is resolve to loosen or free ourselves from those shackles and blinds we have to our awareness, to our heart, to our pains, to our joys. It's interesting, in the last week or so, 10 days, I've had one person come and tell me that I never talk about joys, the joy of spiritual practice, Another person had told me, I never talk about the great tragedies and how they relate to our spiritual practice. So maybe I kind of avoid extremes. So awareness is the solvent of our lives. Isn't that nice? The solvent, that which loosens or frees or unties. And I think resolve is not passive. This practice is not passive. It's very easy to talk about this practice in a passive way, talk about acceptance, talk about receptivity. But acceptance and receptivity are not passive acts. It takes, at times, a tremendous amount of energy, or I prefer to use the word resolve, to remain open and present and aware. But it's also not an aggressive practice. I don't know what the opposite of passivity is. Maybe it's aggression or striving. I looked up striving in the dictionary. And the root of striving is from an old French word which means to quarrel or to argue or to struggle. Maybe that's why I don't like the word striving. Resolve. When I think of resolve in relationship to my own spiritual practice, meditation practice, I think of it as an integrated activity which integrates or involves or includes things like my posture, awareness, purpose, confidence, enthusiasm, effort, investigation. It includes a lot of different things. It's not a single thing. But in particular, I think it includes posture. And I think taking a posture of resolve, usually we say take an upright and alert but relaxed posture. But how about taking an upright, alert, relaxed, resolved posture? A posture which sits with resolution. And there's something you do with your body. I'm going to sit here. And you make the body the container that is dedicated, is devoted to, I like the word devotion today, devoted to opening to what is happening and staying open, staying present repeatedly. It's so easy to turn away. I think it's because it's so easy to turn away, that's why spiritual life is so difficult. So we resolve to be present. We resolve to listen with the great heart. We resolve to listen with the big heart of the Dharma. And then we devote ourselves. There can be a devotion to this resolve. Devotion to resolving to have an open heart. And we do this with our presence. We do it with our posture, our attention. And we also do it through regular, ongoing, continual practice. How does your resolve for spiritual life manifest itself? How do you bring it into action? How do you follow through with it? And that's a question each person needs to answer for themselves. But do we follow through on it? And while resolve can be dissolving, resolve can be freeing and loosening, I think resolve can also be quite firm. And sometimes necessary to sit with great firmness. And I'm thinking, for example, that one of the things that occasionally you need to be able to do is to say no to things. And you won't hear that very much from me because I'm always emphasizing including everything, not denying anything, and kind of affirming everything rather than denying or saying no. But, for example, sometimes we have these thoughts that come up in meditation, ongoing thoughts. And sometimes they have nothing to do with anything important at all. And you've tried to be mindful of them, you've tried to include them in the way we kind of give instructions for mindfulness practice, and they keep coming back, maybe because there's not much effort, we're kind of swimming on the surface chatter of the mind. At some point, the best thing to do is just say no to them. Say enough. You know, stop. There's the image of the sword of wisdom they have in Buddhism. It comes from the warrior school of Buddhism. But sometimes, you know, I think you have to bring out that sword and simply say, enough already. You know, rather than trying to be kind to it or be open to it or try to explore it, investigate, say, enough, just stop this chatter or this concern. So you can go deeper, so you can open your heart in a deeper way. Resolve is not an obligation or a duty. I think resolve comes out of, hopefully comes out of, should come out of some natural and innate intention that you've discovered for yourself. If you find what your own deepest intention is, and then you sit with that with resolve. And even though resolve can be quite firm with a tremendous devotion and dedication, it doesn't involve a willing. It's not willing ourselves, but rather it's resolve involves a willingness. Willingness to let things unfold as they wish. A willingness. There was an article in today's Chronicle about magic. I don't know how many people saw it. And how interest in magic is on the upswing. And how whenever there's war and social disruption, interest in magic increases. When people feel like they're losing control of their lives, they look for magic, for simple solutions. And in the age of addiction that we have, I think we're very much living in an age of addiction. We're looking for magic, for magical solutions to our life. Addiction itself is a kind of result of maybe kind of magical thinking, maybe. We're trying to use something outside of ourselves, technology or drugs, to fix ourselves. And by doing so, we try to will what cannot be willed. There's an attempt for many of us to try to control that which is uncontrollable, or to run away from what's uncontrollable, or run away. And I think that very much the cauldron of mindfulness, the result, this resolve we sit with, is resolve not to get, in some senses, to give up control. And I don't know if that's is that a paradox, to sit with great resolve and to give up control at the same time. There was a movie some years ago called Field of Dreams. And I think the guy heard these voices, and the voices said, build it and he will come. And so he did. And he had all this resolve and dedication. He built this baseball field. And he didn't know why he was doing it. And then they came. All these baseball players from the past, these ghosts. And I think that's a little bit how our practice works. We don't build baseball fields, but we build it and it comes. We build it with our posture, our openness. We build a cauldron for ourselves. We build an open receptivity. We build a trust. We build dedication. We build skills and investigation. And then we see what comes. Something will come. It's kind of not, so there's a kind of passivity, receptivity in this practice. A tremendously powerful, firm resolve. And then also receptivity for something new to happen. Something else will come. So then I looked up the word commitment in the dictionary. And I was delighted to find out that commitment apparently comes from, originally meant something like to join or to connect. And that was really nice. And I think that commitment, perhaps, is a resolve which has opened up to others. For many people, when they first practice, the practice is very much about themselves. Maybe it should be that way. And opening to themselves. But at some point, the barriers between self and other become weaker, and we feel much stronger heart-to-heart connection with others. Our heart opens to others. And then I think that the resolve can change to commitment. And the whole sense of practice, spiritual practice, can have a sense of commitment. You're doing it no longer for yourself, but you're doing it for others also. You're doing it to be available for others, to be helpful to others. Someone asked me earlier today about how you should protect yourself from being mugged. And this is not exactly what you said, but more or less about guns and what you should do. If we make decisions based on our fear, we'll make very different decisions than if we make decisions based on our interconnectedness. And often people want to base it on their fear, so they go out and get a gun. But what happens if you feel connected to society at large, or you feel connected to the mugger, or you can imagine that and kind of exercise? Would you still get a gun? If you include more than just yourself in the picture, would you make a different decision than you would if you were only responding to your fear? So maybe commitment, as I like to define it tonight, is resolve which is open to others. And then I'll end by saying that resolve is very important. And one of the things I learned from the Vipassana practice was resolve. I sat with Upandita, who, as I mentioned, has a warrior attitude. And I learned resolve from him. I didn't learn to be a warrior, which is what he was trying to teach me. But I'll forever be grateful for him for teaching me resolve. And sitting with a tremendous... I learned to sit with steadiness. To sit really in steadiness with whatever was happening. But resolve shouldn't be too serious or grim. And you should remember that if you keep both feet firmly planted on the ground, you won't get your pants on. So, maybe we can have one or two questions. And I don't know how well I talked about resolve, except I just mostly wanted to bring it up and put it out there in our collective minds that at least you should think about resolve. And what's your resolve? Any question or comment? Nidik. Thank you. Yeah. Well, I just kind of made it up for today. There's an expression in, especially in Zen, the big mind. And Zen is kind of, it's a practice, you base your practice on the big mind. Rather than the small mind, the small self. And the big mind is the mind of the universe somehow. So today I was thinking, well, the big heart. We all kind of, the big heart of the Dharma, the big heart. We open not to our own hearts necessarily, just our own heart, but the heartfulness of the heartfulness of the universe. It isn't just a big mind, a universal mind, but it's a universal heart in a sense. Now, I don't want to talk any more about this because I don't want to make it into metaphysics. I'm not sure what I mean, but it's just more of a sense. Oh, yeah. Oh, I don't know about that. I kind of doubt it. But, I mean, often what you hear, often people talk about how in Asian languages, it's true in Sanskrit, it's true in Chinese and Japanese, that the word for heart and mind is the same thing. And that's only partially true, because they have words for things which only refer to mind, and they have words that only refer to heart. But the very common use is the word in Sanskrit or Pali, it's citta. In Japanese, it's shin, or kokoro. If they say kokoro, it means heart. But it's the same character, shin. But shin can be either mind or heart. And if you ask them where their mind is, where their heart is, or where their mind is, where their thoughts are, sometimes they'll point to their chest in some Asian cultures. So people often say that, but what that means exactly in that culture, I'm not sure of. I think that some Asian cultures, and this is a kind of maybe a simplistic generalization, tend to be much more closely connected to their body. They're more embodied to begin with. And when you're more embodied, I think you're more connected to your heart or your open-heartedness or to your warmth or whatever. And so their practice is informed by that embodiedness and that heartfulness in a way that people in the West who aren't so much in their body, will receive and hear the teachings very differently. One friend of mine who's practiced a lot, done a lot of Tibetan practice, and lived in Nepal for a long time with Tibetans, feels very strongly about this. He says that you go hang out with Tibetans, they're completely in their body. But the Tibetan teaching, is very much about being in the mind. And it's kind of a balance to the Tibetan culture. But here, us Westerners, start learning these mind practices of Tibetan Buddhism. And we've actually skipped over the essential embodiment part, which the Tibetans didn't have to learn because they just had it growing up, I guess. So I don't know much about this, but I'm just exploring it with you. Yes?
I've been thinking, why is the Heart Sutra called the Heart Sutra?
Well,
it seems to be more than
a mind.
A mind concern.
The Heart Sutra. Yeah, might be. I think there's a situation where the original word, what it meant originally was not so much a heart, but it meant essence, the essential sutra. But when we came to America and we translated it kind of very literally to heart, it works really well for us. Because then the sutra basically says, to paraphrase it, it says there is no heart. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no object of mind, no sounds, no smells, no touch, no suffering, no origin of suffering, no ignorance, no cause of ignorance, no attainment, no path, no heart. But there's resolve.